My name is Herb, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Herb.
And I am really, really happy to be here. And it's warm. Yeah, I see the fans going. It's interesting because this is my weather. I come from Los Angeles. I don't give it a second thought, except that I'm normally used to air conditioning. So I get to the Quality Inn on Thursday. I get into my room, and it's a lovely little room with a beautiful view. You have just gorgeous views from all over the place around here. And it's really warm in the room. And I look at the gauge on the wall, and it doesn't have a clicker on it. So I called down. I said, "It looks to me like your air conditioning unit is faulty. How can I turn it on?" Huge pause. "We don't have air conditioning. Open the window." And I had an occasion to meet Armin last night. He drove me home from a meeting, and he was telling me that he had been on the committee for several years, and that typically the weather is overcast, cold, even wet, very dreary. So I'm really glad to see that we have this kind of weather potential up here for me today, and it's just wonderful, and we'll suffer through the heat. So, and I want to thank Matt for being so gracious today and during my stay here. And of course, Michael has been so communicative with me when he first asked me to do this several months ago. He has absolutely stayed in touch and been Johnny on the spot to the extent of what kind of juice do I like in my room. I mean, he treats me better than my wife, you know. It's just wonderful. So, and Scott picked me up from the airport, saw him in a suit and tie. He cleans up pretty nice, actually, so that's great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, the hospitality is just wonderful here. I live on a peninsula, just like you do. It's called Palos Verdes. I do, yeah. And so I'm familiar with the kind of the geography, except yours is really gorgeous and beautiful. Ours is okay, so. I don't really trust air I can't see. My sobriety date is February 21st, 1984. And you'll hear that that's an absolute act of grace. My sponsor's name is Lloyd. I've had him from the beginning. And my home group, and I do have a home group, is the Walteria Men's Stag Step Book Study Crosstalk Meeting. That's a mouthful, isn't it? So we just usually call it the Walteria Big Book Study. And you'll hear more about that as I go on, I'm sure. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened and what it was like. We'll emerge from all of that and then what it's like now. A little bit of a change up in the formula that typically we use, because it's what happened to me that allowed me to see what it was like. I was not able to see what it was like. I was so immersed in it. I did not know that I did not know, and I could not see that I did not see. I'm not being poetic or particularly cute. I'm saying this is absolutely my experience, and it still startles me today when I think about it or talk about it. So my wife, we were married in 1966, and we still are. You'll hear the miracle of that as I go through the story. Went into the hospital on February 10th, 1984, for her alcoholism. Thank God. She was a falling down drunk. She had to drink every day, and every time she drank till she passed out. A disgusting lack of willpower and self-care. You know, I really did judge her. And so we have three children, now adult children. We had been all concerned about mom's drinking. And when we went to church, we prayed about that. Mom usually wasn't with us. And on Saturdays, we had this ritual, especially in the last 5 years. We would go to the Red Onion Mexican restaurant in our area to have lunch, me and the three children, because she was probably sleeping it off from the night before, to talk about mom's drinking. Now, my kids at that time were 16, 13, and 10. We did not go to McDonald's. We went to the Red Onion because at the Red Onion they serve margaritas, and that would allow me to talk freely with my children. And they never made the margaritas strong enough, so I always got a double tequila back. That's what you do when you have lunch with your children on Saturday, to talk about your mother's drinking. I could not see that I did not see. And we were planning on going on a weekend trip up to our mountains called Big Bear. And I was to pick her up at 3 o'clock, and she was to have the kids all ready. And we were going with really good friends. And this was like February 7th. And I came home at 3 o'clock, and she's just drunk. I mean, she's really bad drunk. And she's not going anyplace, she tells me. She hasn't picked up the kids. And she has said she's called her counselor and she's going to the hospital for her inpatient program. I didn't even know she knew about stuff like that. And I said, well, would you like me to drive you? And she said, no, you SOB, you should be going. It was pretty offensive. So she drove off in the car with her counselor, who had one of those tops that go down, and she just waved goodbye. And that was the beginning of our journey. It was a wonderful hospital program in San Pedro. This was the golden age of insurance reimbursement. So hospitals and doctors were maximizing the opportunity to help people. And it was a family program. So the hospital asked me to bring the three kids to the hospital program 3 nights a week from about 5 o'clock till about 9 o'clock. We would be there, and I agreed to do that. And so 3 nights a week, I would pick all three of them up, take them there, and we would have an hour where we were all separate. The kids were in one room with kids. I was in a room with other significant others of the people who were incarcerated in the hospital, and my wife was in her group. This is an important kind of a setup because it was really very instrumental in the recovery process. And on February 20th, I came there after having taken my boss to the airport, and we'd had a little time, so we had a couple cocktails, wishing him well on his way and preparing me to go to the hospital program to support her recovery. And the hospital, when I finished with my group meeting that night, said, you've been drinking. I had a couple drinks with my boss. He says, well, no, you're supposed to not drink during the 90 days of her recovery program. I did not know that. He told me that he had told me, but I didn't hear it. And I said, no problem. No problemo, okay? So on February 21st, I woke up ready to go to work in the most horrible depression and anxiety and overwhelming sense of impending doom that I had ever felt. And I had prided myself on not feeling much. Well, I'm very task-oriented, and feelings are very inefficient. They require that you think about other people. And when you think about other people, it really slows you down. I like to get the tasks done. There usually was a wake of bodies behind me, but I did get the task done. Corporate America loves task-oriented people. Anyway, this counselor who asked me to quit drinking said, "So how's the group going?" And I said, "Well, you know what? I really like group therapy. I've had a lot of individual therapy, and I've had a lot of group therapy prior to my coming here. I studied to be a psychologist for 6 years, receiving a graduate education in psychology, being trained as an intern to do therapy, and as part of that, I was getting therapy." And I said, "You know, the counselor who's conducting the group is okay. I could probably do a better job, but it's okay." And he said, "So how are you getting along in the group?" And I said, "You know, I just love therapy. I mean, you get to get down on it, and you get to talk to people, and you get to feel your stuff, and you know, And he goes, "Okay." I said, I really like the process, but I can't identify with the people in the room, these significant others. But for some reason, I can identify with the people they're talking about." I did not know what I was saying. But he said, "We know. We're moving you to the inpatient MnSTAG alcoholic ward. You'll be the only outpatient." Now, you have to hear, I'm going to say lots of stuff about my experience, because I've had lots of experience, wonderful experience. And I have lots of information, because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love our history, and I love our prehistory, and I love all of the literature that we have, and a lot of outside stuff, too. So hopefully you'll learn something and maybe even enjoy it. However, if you only hear one word from me tonight, it's willingness. I was willing to go to the hospital to support her recovery. I was willing to stop drinking when they asked me to stop. I was willing to participate in those sessions wherever they were, and to take direction from that hospital to share in the group therapy and to transfer into this alcoholic men's group. And in that group, I was willing to write out what they called a first step. It's not our first step. It's an approximation. And it was an answer to the question, what is your relationship with alcohol? What is your autobiography? What is your story about alcohol? See, the hospital knew that I was an alcoholic. But they also knew that I did not know, and that I didn't have a clue. So they didn't say to me, "You're an alcoholic. Get out of denial, admit the truth, and get on with it." They didn't do that, because what I would have said to them, and they probably intuited that, is, "And the horse you rode in on." So they asked me a very safe question. And what I've come to see is that the question is so much more important than the answer. Because if you don't have a well-phrased question that you internalize, the answer is meaningless. Lots of people say the Big Book is a book of answers, and it clearly is. But more importantly, it's a book of questions. What's wrong with me? And now what do I do? It's a wonderful set of questions. And so this question created a tension in me that if I held the question and approached it honestly, I got this result. I began to write out, "Oh, I really hate that father drunken slob of my parent, who in fact was 6'4", 260 pounds, former military police, former street cop, mean to the gills, and always wanted to fight me. I hate him." My experience with alcohol, his. Then I wrote about my first drinking experience. I'm age 13. I have a friend who meets with me on a Friday night in his little room out by his parents' place, a garage behind the house, ideal for teenagers. And he had secured a quart of whiskey and a six-pack of beer. And we didn't know much about anything. He probably knew more than I did because he was the thief. But anyway, we drank a little beer, and it was really delicious. I liked it. We drank a little whiskey, and I didn't like it. It burned a lot. And so what we did was we mixed the beer and the whiskey. Well, it smoothed it out, you know. Yeah. And what I know is, from writing out this little story, now I'm 43 years old when I'm writing this, all right? 43 years old when I'm writing this little story. I have never thought about it previous to that, despite all of the therapy that I'd had and all the other self-reflection exposure that I'd had, which I might talk about. But he said, but I saw for the very first time that I drank all there was. I got knee-buckling drunk. We had a lot of fun. I remember the first half of it. And I blacked out, and I passed out, and I woke up, 13 years old, I woke up covered in my own vomit. Never gave it a thought. Cleaned it all up, went on our way. And by the time I had written for about 20 minutes, I saw that over the next 30 years that was my drinking pattern. That I drank regularly. I drank all there was. I never left before it was over or closed or we ran out. I blacked out. I got knee-buckling drunk. I passed out. And I regularly vomited in order, because I'm sort of athletically oriented and health oriented, and I didn't want that stuff in my guts all night. So when I finally got home, I would do this and get rid of it. My daughter, who is in the OA program, heard me speak once. And she said, "Dad, you voluntarily threw up for 15 years? Maybe you have another problem." "I know, I'm just health conscious. Don't you understand?" Because I'm a runner, right? I'm a runner. I was going to run every morning, and I did 4 miles, regardless of when I got home or how I felt. I would run. I'm a bulldog that way. And so, but you know, at the conclusion of that writing, 20, 30 minutes, I was startled. Not that I had a drinking problem. My father's an alcoholic. My wife's an alcoholic. Both her parents, second generation Irish Catholics, are alcoholics. One a pantry drunk and one an alley drunk. Really bad stuff. And I've been surrounded by alcoholics all my life. I was not startled that I was an alcoholic. I was startled that I had never seen it. How can you miss something like that? And what you don't know, because I haven't told you, is that at age 17, I'm standing in front of a judge in the Long Beach Municipal Court with both my parents standing behind me. And he's got a little folder like this that he's holding. And he said, "Mr. Kagan." He was referring to me and not my father. And he said, "In this folder, I see on the left-hand side that you are an A student. You are president of your class. You are the captain of the football team. And you are the president of the altar boys. On the right-hand side, I see that in your freshman year, you were drunk and disorderly in public. In your sophomore year, you were arrested for drunk and disorderly and carrying a concealed weapon. And in your, you are here in front of me today because you were drunk and disorderly. And you have a series of 32 grand theft auto charges." I said, "Well, yeah, that's all me." I did not see the dichotomy of those two sheets, you know. And he said, Your partner in crime, 17 years old, I have just sentenced to 2 years in youth authority and sent him away. He said, I'm prepared to do that to you, except I'm a little puzzled. In this folder, there is also an application for the Catholic priesthood, which has been accepted. And you have the opportunity to go in the seminary or go to jail. I said, oh, I'm going to the seminary. And I was intending to. But do you understand the lack of ability to perceive reality that is evidenced in what I just told you? You heard my history for 3 years, and I'm making an application to be a priest. Not ever seeing the incompatibility of those two activities. And that is part of my history, not being able to see. And so for the first year that I was in the seminary, I was the only seminarian that had to call once a month to his probationary officer. And it was not your regular seminary, it was a monastery. And it was a monastery that required silence 24/7. And I loved it. And I was there for 7 years. Yeah. I was in there for 7 years. I got a tremendous exposure to spirituality. I got a tremendous exposure to the Catholic tradition. I got tremendous exposure to some really wise and holy people. But it didn't touch me. But it didn't touch me. And I believe it was my alcoholism was at work that made a decision for me to leave the seminary. You don't get a lot of alcohol in the seminary. Every once in a while when we did, I drank all there was. I got knee-buckling drunk. I blacked out and I passed out. But I began to see the fact that I had three vows at that time. It was a religious order. I was in the order from ages 17 to 24. I had the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Pretty heavy duty for 17 to 24. And I had a moment of clarity when I saw that I was sneaking out after 10 with money I had stolen from the order to go to the bar to drink and to be with her. And I went, I finally did see the incompatibility. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. No, this doesn't work. I better go. So that's when I decided to be a psychologist. Because if I can't save your soul, at least I'll heal your mind. But alcohol drove me out of that, I know. I made a right turn on that too, and then paid attention to business. But all during that time, in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, at least in Southern California, we had a lot of self-help stuff going on. And if it was made available to me and I knew about it, I would spend whatever time and money and effort to do it. And I'm talking about yoga, transcendental meditation, S training, Life Springs, psychics, hypnosis. In terms of health, I quit eating all red meat. Any carbonated drinks, anything with caffeine, salt and pepper, anything white like sugar, bread, and dairy products. And I'm on a health kick. But I never saw alcohol as a non-healthy activity. Do you know that in those years, and there were 20 years of heavy drinking, 23 to 43, in those years, never once did I ever look at my drinking and say, that's not healthy. Never once did I look at my behavior and say, that's caused by drinking. Never once did I make any real effort at control or modification. And it just amazes me today that I was doing all these other things for my mental and spiritual and physical health, and I never once put alcohol in the equation. Blind. See, and this is the insidious part of our disease. the subversive part of our disease. It's the only disease that tells us that we don't have disease. It blinds us from the truth. I was living in a delusion, thinking it was the truth, and it was a lie. And believing the lie, I manifested that in my life. And my life was a train wreck. But I'm a really hard worker, very task-oriented, reasonably intelligent, reasonably well-educated, have a decent personality when I'm not drinking, and so therefore I made quite a nice success in the business world. So I'm writing all this out, and I'm seeing it for the very first time in 1984. But I didn't emphasize it, and I want to now, about February 20th and February 21st. You may have heard it, but I really want to make sure that you do hear what happened. On February 20th, they asked me to quit drinking. On February 20th, I did not have a problem with alcohol. No. In here. And I did not want to quit drinking. I did not pray to quit drinking. I did not go to AA. I did not talk in therapy about drinking. On February 21st was my first day without alcohol, and that is my birthday. I didn't go to AA for another 6 weeks. A grace. This is what we mean by powerlessness, is that recovery and abstinence is a gift. It's nothing that we can get by what we do, and it's nothing that we can earn by who we are or know. And I know that clearly today. Now, some of you haven't had such a gracious entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of you have had the experience of relapse. And I sponsor a lot of people, and there's a mixed variety of drinking patterns and recovery patterns. All right, and I do know that there is something that you need to do to demonstrate willingness, and it's the willingness that connects to the grace that is the alchemy of recovery. I can't explain how it works. Really good friends and relatives of mine have died trying. Not too hard. We read chapter 5 tonight, as we normally do in the opening of a meeting, and it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And my little take on that is, rarely have we seen a person thoroughly follow our path. I'm going to talk about being thorough tonight. You hear the motto all the time, easy does it. It's not my motto. My motto is heavy does it. All right? That's it. Get involved like a bulldog and hang on with a full grip and do what you're told and take the actions no matter what you think and no matter what you feel. The hospital said, okay, now you think you have a drinking problem. Notice, I didn't cop to being an alcoholic. I said, oh, wow, looks like I have a drinking problem. They said, okay, why don't you try AA? And so I went up to a meeting. And they sit around. It's a men's stag. It's one of my, I have two actual home groups that I consider them home groups because I've been going to them every week for 24 years in one case, in the book study for 20 years. I'll talk about that in a minute. And wanted to try that. And they were sitting in a room and in a circle. And I'm a quick study. I walk in the room, case it out. I see what they're doing. And I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Ed, I'm an alcoholic. I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I'm Herb exploring being an alcoholic. They did just that. Yeah, they laughed gently. And I didn't know anything when I'm in it, but when I look back on it, what I know is that I knew intuitively they were not laughing at me, that there was some type of a recognition, camaraderie, and welcome. I knew that intuitively, not here. I didn't know what was going on. I was too scared about it all. And after doing that for 2 or 3 weeks, and hearing the meeting and hearing the hospital, because they had family afterward kind of lecture series about the family disease and the genetic predisposition and all of that, which is so relevant, at least in my life and my family. And I really got it. And so I, about 3 weeks later, and this is at the end of March probably, I go, okay, I think I'm an alcoholic. I'm Herb, I'm an alcoholic. And as soon as I said that, the meeting said, get a sponsor. I can do that. See, I knew this guy, Lloyd, who was a drinking buddy of mine 12 years earlier. He taught me about expense account drinking because he was a client of mine. And he was really responsible for my first drunk driving arrest in 1968, the first of two. And I was responsible for his last drunk driving arrest in 1972, at the end of 1972. He was leaving my house after a New Year's Eve, where we had sat there, he and I, with a couple quarts of some really fine scotch. And we had Jesus Christ Superstar on the hi-fi, and we sang the arias. Jesus Christ. Oh, we just had a ball. You know, he had to drive home. That was his problem. It turned out to be his problem. He ended up in the Pasadena jail. And the next day, he realized that he had a problem. I guess it was a whole series of learning for him. And he went into AA. And I thought he should. He was a really bad drunk. Couldn't hold his liquor at all. Would just fall down wherever he was. And it was just... drank way too much. All right. And so he's the only person I know in AA, and he's 6'4", 260 pounds, and probably a father image. I didn't know that then. I know that now. And Irish Catholic, in my business. And I said, Lloyd, I'd like you to be my sponsor. I'm in AA now. You know, he was so respectful. He did not say, well, it's about time, dummy. No, he didn't say, well, I've been keeping a seat for you, jerk. You know what you hear in some really rough and tough AA meetings? No, he didn't say any of that. He said, yes, I'll be your sponsor. And I have one condition. And I said, well, what's that? He says, you call me every day. I said, why would I do that? He said, because if you don't, I'll fire you. Oh, okay, I'll do that. Well, now, you don't know this about me, but you might suspect I'm a fairly self-motivated person who reads a lot and who doesn't like to share who I am or what I'm doing with anybody, and I certainly don't want to be held accountable. And so I said, well, what will we talk about? And he said, here's the formula, Herb. I want you to tell me what you're thinking and feeling and doing, because your thinking is demented from 30 years of drinking. You have no feelings because you've anesthetized them from 30 years of drinking. And oh, by the way, you will thaw out and they will return, and that won't be good news. And your behavior is a function of your demented thinking and your anesthetized feelings. He says, you're a train wreck. He says, I'm in the same business as you are. I know the people that you work with. He says, I am constantly getting complaints about you, or the street has a lot of gossip about you. He said, you're an absolute train wreck. So I began the journey of calling him every day and telling him what I was thinking, feeling, and doing. And he said the goal of that is to be transparent. And he defined that as matching my outsides with my insides. I didn't know what he meant at the time. I do now. And I began that journey of telling him who I was and what I was doing and how I was feeling and holding myself accountable. And most of the time I told the truth. But you don't, you know, it's progress, not perfection, we read, right? And then he said, all right, I want you to get a big book, and I want you to read it, and I want you to work the steps. Sounds good, right? 2 out of 3 were solid. Get a book and read it. He assumed because I'm educated and I read English and relatively intelligent that I could figure it out, the book, the steps. And it was the direction that he had received from his sponsor, so he didn't know any different. So here's how it worked for me. First step, I'm in AA. Got it. Second step, I'm a trained theologian. I had 2 courses in theology. But you see the delusion? I had worn the black garment for a long time, so he thinks he's got some spiritual stuff. He doesn't. It's a lie. But anyway, that was my thought. And third step, I surrender. So I got steps 1 through 3 done in 2.5 minutes on my own, and I faced the 4th step, and I got the big book, and I read it. Could not understand it. Got the 12 and 12, read it. Wonderful commentary, but there are no instructions in chapter 4. Oh, there's some questions, but there are no real instructions. I got the Hazleton literature. I got the literature from the hospital. I got the literature from the meetings. And I'm an academically oriented person by training and preference. And so I set it all out on this desk, and I did nothing. Paralysis by analysis, they call it. So I called Lloyd, and I said, I can't get started. He said, okay. He says, do what will come very naturally to you, write about yourself. And he said, write an autobiography. You know, it was really good advice as far as it went. It didn't go far enough, but it was good advice. And it actually is big book based. If you look at chapter 5, it says we tell someone, excuse me, chapter 5. If we look at step 5, It says, we tell someone all, it's in italics, the big book's way of highlighting, we tell someone all our life story. That sounds like an autobiography. And so I did that, and I did a long, but not too long, 5th step with him, and got on through the 6th and 7th step, and made a list of the people I harmed, and then I went around saying, this was my 9th step, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, I really am sorry. It was such a sorry 9th step. I did exactly what the big book says not to do. It says something mumbling that we're sorry is not good enough. I won't quote it. I'm paraphrasing. And as the result of working the first 9 steps out of the big book, on my own, in the first year of my recovery, nothing happened. I wasn't expecting anything to happen. I did what I was told. I went to a meeting every day. That was his instruction for the first year. And sometimes when I was in trouble at work, which was a lot because I have authority figures, I know now psychologically because of my family of origin relationship or bad relationship with my father and all of that. It's explored for another day. But I had authority problems, all right? I didn't like to take direction. I didn't like to be held accountable. And my only principle that I operated on was self-gratification and immediate gratification. No delayed gratification, thank you. Do you think I had any trouble at work? Oh, yeah. So I stayed restless, irritable, and discontent for the first 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I went to meetings, but I treated them like group therapy. They said to us, and you've heard it, come, at least in the 80s, maybe not so much anymore, come back, keep coming back, and share your stuff with us. They didn't realize I had a double load of fertilizer, that I would back up to the meeting, every meeting, and I would just lay it on them, like group therapy, you know. And they said, keep coming back, and I did. I think some of them changed meetings. And I began to sponsor some people. One of the things my sponsor did right away, you go to a meeting early and you stay late. 5:10 on the one side, 5:10 on the other side. In those days, even that long ago, 24 years ago, they had porcelain cups for coffee and ashtrays because all of the meetings were smoking where I was located. And he said, you help clean up all of that. And you know, it was really great advice because I'm uncomfortable, at least I was in those days, dealing with anybody in small talk or conversation. But if I can stand next to you at a sink and wash cups and not have any direct eye contact, but we can have some kind of meaningless conversation or meaningful, you know, whatever, that works for me, and it makes me feel part of, all right? I mean, at 6 months of sobriety, despite the rules in that particular meeting to have 1 year of sobriety, they gave me the treasurer's job. And I said, well, I only have 6 months. They said, that's okay. Our last treasurer had 5 years and ran away with the kitty. So, you know, they felt safe with me. They didn't have any money anyway at that time. But it made me feel part of. And then I would make sure that I was there at that meeting. So it was wonderful, wonderful direction to go to meetings like that. But you know, and you hear it all the time. And I used to think that meetings were the heart of AA. That's what we do, the essence. There's lots of other stuff. There's a lot of moving parts, but meetings, that's it. But going to meetings expecting transformation is like sitting in your garage waiting for you to become a Volvo. You're not going to change by sitting in meetings. Now, you'll get some ideas, but it does require action. Notice the title we have up here. All right? Recovery in action, right? Through action. Recovery through action. Perfect. Through action. It's not what we think. It's not what we feel. It's not what we know. It is what we do. I didn't know any of that. But I was willing to take direction. I was just getting poor direction. And I suffered for 4 years as the result of that. Restless, irritable, and discontent. All right? Came close to a nervous breakdown at one point because I was having trouble at work. I'd been working for this company for 21 years. I helped build it. I was one of their senior officers. And one of the other senior officers grew not to like me. And, well, he was a little demented too. And he put together a posse to drive me out of the company. And that's why at the beginning of 1988 in February, I decided to rework the steps. Now, that wasn't being talked about in the meetings that I was attending at that time, much more frequently today, at least in Southern California, about reworking the steps. And I know that that was a grace, but it was probably one of those graces that you get when you go to meetings and you somewhat listen. Seeds are planted that you don't even know are planted. And at some point, when the right climate is the conditions, that seed will sprout. Well, in February of 1988, because of all the trouble in my work, I thought I should rework the steps, especially in light of the fact that my fifth anniversary was going to come up the following February. You know how we are. February 21st, I've turned four. On February 22nd, I'll soon be five. You know, we... Yeah. Well, we project it, and I thought, well, listen, this is going to be a watershed event, 5 years, and so I'll rework the steps in honor of that and perhaps to help solve my work problem. I don't think it was that conscious at that time. But here's the real grace. I was going to a morning meeting, 7 o'clock, and it's an hour meeting, 5 minute share maximum per person. And I heard a man share 2 weeks in a row. Now, what he said must have had some substance, otherwise I wouldn't have listened to it, all right? But I don't remember what he said. What I do remember absolutely distinctly is the way he walked. Tall man, probably 10 years older than me at the time, still is. and he had this light in his eyes that was just visible, and he had this tone in his throat when he spoke, this resonance, this warmth, this invitation. when he spoke that my needle just pointed north. And I went up and I said, Jerry, I'm thinking of reworking the steps in honor of my upcoming fifth birthday in a year. Thank you. And he took me out in the parking lot and did exactly what chapter 7 asks us to do. He got to know me. I call it an interview. And after an hour of him asking me questions about who I was and what my journey had been and what my religious experiences were and what my family conditions were, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, he said, yes, he would. And tomorrow, if you care to come to the workshop, I'm going to give an overview of that experience in some more detail than I'm able to do tonight. We'll spend probably an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes drilling down from steps 1 through 12, which is what he did. He said, we're going to take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to have it as our textbook. And I'm going to give you assignments of prayer and reading and reflection and writing and discussion. It had five parts. Prayer, reading, reflection, writing, and discussion. We're going to take each step, one step at a time, and in fact, within the steps, we will have assignments because there are different components to each of the steps. I don't know what he was talking about. I said, sure, Jerry, great. Give me the goddamn assignment, would you? So the prayer he gave me was the set-aside prayer. You may or may not have heard about it. It's not in the big book or any of our approved literature, but it comes from aspects of the big book that suggest we set aside our old ideas. You know, I don't read Einstein, but there's a quote that I picked up, which I really like, and he said, the consciousness that created the problem cannot be the consciousness that solves the problem. I'm going to repeat it. The consciousness that created the problem cannot be the consciousness that solves the problem. He said, Herb, you've got a lot of information. You've got a lot of experience. You've got a lot of exposure. It hasn't done you much good. Yeah, he spoke the truth, all right? He said, I want to have you have an experience from your heart, not your head. I had no idea what he was talking about. I do now, and I was willing to make that effort. And so he gave me this prayer to set aside my experience, to set aside my information, to set aside my expectations of the steps, and to set aside even my understanding about who and what God is. To set it all aside for a whole new experience with who I am, what my disease is, who God is, and what this spiritual path is. You see, I don't know what to aspire to, so how can I aspire to it? But what I've learned is, through this prayer, through this process, through this book, and through these steps, I was taken to a place that I didn't even know existed. I was willing to have that material set aside, my past, so that in fact I could be open for a present and a future. And he took me into step one. And I had never read the doctor's opinion so intelligently with a highlighter. I didn't realize that there was something wrong with my body. Oh, that explains why when I sit down in the saloon to have a couple drinks, having promised her that I would be home at 7 o'clock, that I have a couple quarts and I don't come home until after the bar closes. And it happened periodically for me. You see, my wife is what I call a chronic alcoholic. She had to drink every day, and every time she drank, she got drunk. That's not my experience. I consider myself what I've termed a periodic alcoholic. It's just as bad, or maybe worse, but I could regularly go down to the saloon and have a glass of whiskey and go home like I promised. I could regularly have a glass of wine at lunch and go back to work as I was supposed to. I could regularly go home and not drink at all that night, even though my wife was drinking, or have a drink and have dinner. She would have a drink and have a drink and have a drink, and dinner was nowhere in sight for her. So I was contrasting her as my benchmark for a problem drinker. And I saw that I'm an alcoholic because periodically, when I began to drink, I drank more than I intended to. Powerless. I saw that. Oh my God. For 20 years. And then the next thought, and I never saw the pattern, which answered the question, what's wrong with my mind? I have a defective mind, the big book suggests. Many of you have already intuited that. The big book uses the term insanity that way. It's not the psychological, psychiatric, psychopathic, sociopathic terminology. Insanity in the big book is used in a very, very defined and technical way. And it's actually defined on page 37 as part of Jim's story. It says a lack of proportion, a lack of the ability to think straight. That's all it is, but that's what it is. My mind doesn't work correctly. In the same way my body does not successfully process alcohol, it produces an allergy and a phenomenon of craving. My body does not successfully process alcohol. My mind does not successfully process reality, especially about alcohol, but I know in other areas too. I don't connect the dots. How could I, with my voracious appetite for self-knowledge and self-help that was evidenced by all of that activity that I've told you about and more, how could I not have seen the truth about back-to-back 502s, hospitalization for car wrecks and bar fights? How could I have, Mr. Clean here. How could I not have connected the dots on missed appointments, trouble at work, trouble at home, financial trouble? How could I have not put together all of the evidence that was absolutely clear to anybody who would look at it objectively? Because I was living in a delusion. Chuck Chamberlain has a book that was transcribed from a retreat that he did called A New Pair of Glasses. Perfect image, perfect image. If I have a pair of glasses on that's blue, everything's going to be blue. And I won't know that it's blue. I'll just know that everything I see is blue because that's the lens through which I look. If it was brown, it would be brown. Chuck speculates that we need a new pair of glasses, which is what the big book and the step process and the process of spiritual awakening gives us, a new pair of glasses. We're able then to have the delusion dissipated. This mask of the lie, this mask of the false self, this mask of the survival instincts that we have created, this story about who I am, this story about who you are, this story about how the world works, which is all a myth, which is all a lie, and we all have it. And we all have it. And we don't know that we have it. And we live our life out of it, wondering why our life doesn't work. The big book uses the analogy of Columbus. And it's almost like a throwaway little story unless you really look at it in the context of the story. What did the world believe at the time of Columbus? That the world was flat. As long as they believed the lie, they could not sail out to the horizon for fear of falling off. They believed a lie, they couldn't discover the truth. I believed lots of lies about who I am, who you are, and how the world works. And therefore, I could not discover the truth. Despite organized religion's effort to crack that mask, despite my efforts at formal psychology to crack that mask, despite all of the efforts of my self-help programs of the 60s and 70s and 80s, and I was sincere, the mask persisted. The false self, the false ego, the shadow side, as Carl Jung calls it, persists. And I was asked to do this fourth step out of the big book. and to take a look at my resentments and analyze them. To get underneath what is my self-esteem. It's not the psychological self-esteem. At least this is the interpretation that was given to me. The big book doesn't define self-esteem. It just says that this is one of the analysis that you do in the third column of the resentment inventory. This man said, it's about my belief system, about who I am. And when I looked at that, my belief system, I said, I believe that I'm a professional man, rather intelligent and well-educated, fairly superior to most people, unique in most every respect, pretty much entitled. You hear? Now, I didn't know that I believed that until I did this work of this analysis in the third column of the resentment inventory, along with those other variables there, and I began to see the lie that I had thought to be the truth. I'm just another human being with some skills, but with some big character defects, which I don't pay any attention to. All right? But I was living on a false belief system. That was the beginning of my spiritual awakening. I did not know that. I never know what's happening to me when it's happening to me. I only know what's happening to me when I look over my shoulder at where I've been, and then I go, oh. Oh. All right? But never when it's happening to me. And Appendix 2 says that, doesn't it? It was put in the book in the second printing of the big book. The very first printing of the big book, step 12 read, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And when it was printed, people thought that they had to have Bill Wilson's experience of the mountaintop, mystical, wind-blowing, mountaintop, white light, immediate and overwhelming sense of the presence of God. Because of the way the books gave those stories and the way the 12th step was worded, and Bill goes, oh, I didn't mean that. Because Bob didn't have that experience. Bob had a gradual experience, a spiritual awakening, and so they printed the second printing and changed the 12th step from experience to awakening, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Then they put Appendix 2 in the back of the book to explain it. What's the difference? There's no difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening in the result. The result is the same. It's an overwhelming change in the way we think and feel and behave, and it's done to us, not by us. It's an overwhelming change in the way we think and feel and behave. Now, organized religion and psychology in a good relationship can do that. But it's done to us, not by us. I submitted to a process, and I was changed. That's the whole point of that. But a spiritual experience is sudden, mystical, like Bill had, and a spiritual awakening is like most of us have, which is William James's variety of religious experiences, which is a slow, gradual, educational variety. And in fact, he said the person who's experiencing it may not even be aware of it. Others may be aware of it before he is. Absolutely my experience. But it was really quickened by the fourth column of the resentment inventory. Now, some people don't call it the fourth column. They call it the second phase because in the big book it doesn't refer to it and it doesn't show it in the matrix on page 65. But it does have a paragraph that says, we turn back to the list and we ask five questions. Where was I selfish and self-seeking and dishonest and frightened? And where was I responsible? Where am I to blame? That was the first time in my 48 years that I had looked at the possibility that I had anything to do with the trouble in my life. Oh, yeah. Laughable. It is laughable. How could you miss it? And yet I missed it. And I began to see that, oh, there's a lot of spiritually sick people. All right? Yeah. A lot of spiritually, my father was a very spiritually sick man, all right? However, I had contributed to his reaction to me, and my reaction to him was my responsibility. Oh, was that new information or what? The 12 and 12 in step 10 has phrases it this way. It's a spiritual axiom. Whenever I am disturbed, there is something wrong with me. God, I hate that. Whenever I am disturbed, they don't cut you any slack. Whenever I am disturbed, there is something wrong with me. But I did get it. I did get it. I began to look at my role, my responsibility, not in the events of my life that I couldn't control, but in my attitude toward them, my feelings about them, my perception about them, and my reaction and behavior around them. And I had never done that. Despite all the therapy, I had never done that. I am not putting down formal religion or formal psychology. Absolutely not. I have a religious tradition which I adhere to and admit openly. I have constantly been in and out of therapy all through my sobriety. But what I do know is that until I did the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I'm describing it, with somebody who knew what they were doing and was able to guide me on their experience, but give me the dignity of my own experience, that therapy was not very effective. It was not effective. Larry did a wonderful job on sponsorship this afternoon, and my mental image of a sponsor is somebody who's had this experience, who is like a lamp post that stands by the side of the path, shining the light of their experience on the path that they have walked, allowing me to walk that path and have my own experience. They're a lamp. Sponsors get into a problem when they think they're the light. That was funny. Anyway, this is what that man did. And he heard my fifth step. He took me through the sixth and seventh step. We'll talk more detail about all of those tomorrow. But especially in the ninth step, he guided me through the ninth step. It was so critically important that he look at each card that I had for my eighth step and ask me, well, so what's the harm? Because I had a lot of guilt and shame. And the eighth step is not about guilt and shame. And the eighth step is not about resentments. The eighth step is about how did I harm them. And I had to answer those questions. Now, he never told me how to conclude it. He just asked me a series of questions based on his experience that I could use then to come to conclusion in prayer about whether or not an amends was due and what was the amend. And he did suggest that the amend be proportionate to the harm done and that it be, in fact, not a simple I'm sorry, which is rather lame, but that might be part of it, but that it be an attempt at healing, that it be an attempt at repair, that it be an attempt at restitution. Not necessarily reconciliation. That was not in my control. And what a process that was. I got to go to the graveyard and to sit at my father's grave and to write a letter to him inviting him in prayer to be present to me as I wrote the letter, taking full responsibility for all the harm that I had done him, never once looking at anything that he had done to me. And then I was to read that letter out loud as if he were there. And it was totally cathartic. I cried and laughed as I read, and I know we were in communication. And when I left that cemetery, I was clean and free of a resentment that had plagued me those 48 years. I had done some prayer around that, as the big book suggests in the resentment inventory. It says, if you have deep resentments, you ask God to remove them. Some people misinterpret that. They think it's about praying for them, the other person. And that's nice, and it's good, and it's spiritually recommended. But that's not the instruction in the big. The instruction is that we pray to the divine healer. We pray to the surgeon to come into our life to cut out this cancer of deep resentment from me. So between the prayer for the removal of this deep resentment and, in fact, the action of the ninth step in that cemetery, I was healed of that deep resentment, and we were reconciled. I had an experience with my mother. She had, was talking about money amends. She had said, lend, and I had heard, give. A rather substantial amount of money. We had a huge disagreement about that. There's a lot of moving parts to this. I won't go into that. But in the final, I did write the check and I paid her back, but she was so angry with the process and the resistance on my part over years that she sold everything that she had and left town. No forwarding address. Yeah, no forwarding address. Now, she'd been very close to my wife and very close to her grandchildren. We have three. And so I'm doing these amends, and I don't know how to find her. Because of my business, I'm connected to the Teamsters, and she got a retirement check because of my father's work. So I went to the Teamsters, and the highest level person I could talk to explained the situation. I don't want to know where she is. But what I want to do is send her a letter along with her pension check. Could you do that for me? And he did. And in that letter, I wrote my amends, and I took full responsibility for my part. And at the end, I said, if there's anything I can do, I would be very happy to help you. And I sent several pictures of our children, none of my wife or myself, because I didn't want to create any antipathy unnecessarily. And in 2 weeks, the letter came back. But it had been received, and it had been opened, and it had been read. But she was so angry with me, she returned the pictures of the kids. Yeah, that's deep anger. But 2 years later, I get a phone call, Herb, this is your mother. You wrote a letter to me 2 years ago, and in the last line you said you'd be willing to help if I ever needed it. I need your help. I've just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I'll be dead in 6 months. And I want to come home and die. Will you help me? And I said, well, sure. I flew up to Reno. And there I think she had a gambling problem. And I went to a little old sleazy motel where I guess she was staying. And she was sitting on a bed, a little shriveled up lady in a polyester suit with one of these little tubes in her nose and a tank by her side and one little tiny suitcase. And this is a woman who in her prime had been a clothes model, 5'8" and regal. And here she was. Brought her home, and my wife and I kept her there until we couldn't, got her hospice care until she died, and we were fully reconciled. Well, you can't get here from there. That kind of reconciliation with a mother who's completely abandoned you and a father who is dead. And yet this program allows us to do that. The most important amend was with my wife. I had betrayed her in every way that a man can betray a woman, and I had demeaned her in every way that one human could another human. And at 25 years of marriage, and as a result of doing this work, I came to her and I said, Mary, I don't know whether to stay or to go. I don't know whether to stay or to go. And I know you're in the same kind of catch-22. Let's stop reading books about marriage. Let's stop going to marriage counseling. Let's stop talking about our relationship and our marriage. They always ended badly anyway, because she would never do what I asked. I said, I'm powerless over this. And I knew this now from the process that I'd just gone through. I said, would you join me in prayer? She's in the program, 23 years, and she's a spiritually oriented person. She thought about it for a day, and then she came back and she said, yes, She says, I will do that because I don't know what to do, whether to stay or to go. And so what we did was, and we sort of made it up ourselves, we got on our knees in front of each other and held hands and looked each other straight in the eye. And one morning I would pray out loud for healing and guidance, not to stay together, not to go apart, but for healing and guidance. And the next morning we got on our knees and held hands and looked each other in the eyes, and then she would pray out loud for healing and guidance. Well, you can't get on your knees in front of a person and hold their hand and look in their eye and pray out loud for healing and guidance and stay mad. And the heat began to go down very quickly. And within a couple, 3 weeks, we could just feel a shift in our relationship. And interestingly enough, and without any suggestion on my part, she began to take some pretty aggressive action about her own spiritual and psychological life. And we just celebrated 43 years of marriage. And we both retired at the same time, and we both live in the same house, and we enjoy each other's company. The highlight of our morning is to have a cup of coffee and to sit for a half an hour sharing with each other what's really going on, how we're feeling, how we're perceiving, what our concerns are, what our ecstasies are, and what our fears are. It's just an awful, wonderful journey. It's not Romeo and Juliet, all right, at all, but it is absolutely a wonderful, intimate friendship. You can't get here from there except by the miracle of these steps and a spiritual process of spiritual awakening. I was taken to a place I didn't even know existed. That personal relationship that I had hungered for in the seminary, in the monastery, I now have. That mental sobriety and emotional maturity that I had glimpses of, at least in a textbook, in the psychology and therapy, I now have that. The only word I can use today is my life flourishes. My oldest daughter is 20 years in OA, 17 in AA. My middle daughter, 17 in Al-Anon. And my son doesn't seem to have any problem that he's aware of or we're aware of. But he said, Dad, he says, if I ever do have a problem with my gambling and my work and my food and my exercise and my drinking, all of which he loves, I know where there's a solution because I've seen you and Mom and my sisters get free. All right? St. Francis says, wherever you go, preach the good news. Wherever you go, preach the good news. If you have to, use words. Thank you.